I'm calling the Senate Education Committee to order at 8 a.m. on Wednesday, March 22nd, 2017. This morning we have present Senator Coghill, Senator Geisel, Senator Begich, and myself, Chair Hughes. I'd like to remind everyone the etiquette regarding their cell phones, and thank you to those assisting us. Today we'll have the first hearing for Senate Bill 87, the School Construction Energy Efficient Standard, sponsored by Senator McKinnon, as well as Senate Bill 96, the Education Schools Teacher Funding by the Senate Education Committee. And with that, I'll invite Senator McKinnon, almost said Faircloth, up with her staff. Please introduce yourselves and proceed to tell us about your bill, please.
For the record, my name is Brittany Hutchison, staff to Senator McKinnon.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the Education Committee. I'm Senator Anna McKinnon, representing Senate District G, Highland Road to Aklutna, basically, and all the bases in between. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am the Capital Budget Chairman, as you're aware, and have been on finance for multiple years. During that time, we have advanced hundreds of millions of dollars of construction across our state. The bill before you today is a look from those experiences and trying to provide a framework to advance some of the design that we do for buildings, public facility buildings, specifically education facilities, to create energy efficiency standards greater than we are currently applying to the buildings that we're making. That we're investing the public's money into. Madam Chair, the goal is to make schools more affordable, maintainable, and to extend the life of the public school facilities. We want long-term operating cost savings. As you know, we've suspended the capital school capital construction debt reimbursement plan. This is an opportunity to lay the foundation so that when a plan goes back into effect, that our investment dollars are utilized and that it will create those long-term savings through energy cost savings. Madam Chair, members of the committee, in smaller communities across Alaska, the state has stood up multiple facilities that could be co-located. And so I would leave it to a task force that's in this bill to establish with the Department of Education different entities that would seem to meld together. As an example, in a smaller community, if you look at your school, and I lived in one of those smaller communities, your school is almost a community center. And so a library, in my opinion, should have be secure and have access to the outdoors so that you could have a private entrance and that library could be used year-round for a smaller community, possibly even a larger community, depending on where they're at. Another co-location idea might be for a fire department to be in the same facility if the state is supporting that, or public safety for there are all kinds of spots that we could have co-location. Another one is health. We have health aids that we pay for lease costs for health aids in different communities. If it was located together, we might see cost savings and benefits both to the school and to the other facility and to the community overall. So as I've said, we are trying to start a conversation about maintaining and controlling costs for school facilities and extend the life of those school facilities and prioritize classroom infrastructure and functional design versus just looking good. And I know that you probably know what I mean by that, but as an example for the public who might be following, our team has been reaching out to the School Board Association, to principals, to superintendents, to classroom teachers, to the department itself, to contractors, to engineers and design firms. And certainly everyone does not agree with everything that's in this bill and have challenges in implementing some of the things in the bill. But in all of that dialogue, what I heard was some districts telling me that the front of the building would consume about 10% of the design or upwards instead of investing that in the classroom where our students are learning. And for me, that just wasn't the right way to invest money. I certainly don't want to take away local control, but I would like these buildings to take a second look at being energy efficient, have a temperature control standards so that we use less energy on a 24-hour cycle than we're currently doing, and look at co-location. With that, Madam Chair, I'm available for questions, and we certainly are prepared to do a walkthrough of what this bill tries to accomplish.
Why don't we do a section analysis first, if we could, Brittany, and then we'll open it up for questions.
Okay. For the record, again, my name is Brittany Hutchison, staff to Senator McKinnon. Thank you for hearing Senate Bill 87 today. With permission of the chair, I would like to start the sectional analysis on Section 10, and then go to 9, and then go back to 1 for ease of understanding.
That works for us. Thank
you. Thank you. Section 10 establishes a public school energy efficiency and standardized components working group in the Department of Education and Early Development for the purpose of recommending energy efficiency standards and standardized component options for energy efficient public school facilities. These recommendations are for all school construction and major maintenance projects that receive a grant or reimbursement in an amount equal to 50% or more of the project costs. The working group consists of 9 members appointed by the Commissioner of Education. The working group shall establish energy efficiency standards, standardized component options for energy-efficient buildings, establish best practices, and establish the maximum cost standards per square foot for a construction project. The maximum cost must prioritize classroom infrastructure and functional design, and the cost must be adjusted for different regions within each climate zone. The working group may meet by telephone or video conference. They will not receive reimbursement, compensation, or per diem. And the working group terminates on the date 18 months after this bill's passage. The recommendations of this working group will then be put into regulation by the Department of Education. Section 9 creates a new section in state law, Alaska Statute 14.11.104, entitled School Facility Design and Maintenance Standards. It requires the Department of Education to establish, by regulation, energy efficiency standards that include standardized component options appropriate for each climate zone in the state. The regulations must also include creating a maintenance manual for schools on how to maintain, operate, and fix component parts, consider establishing a statewide maintenance team. In doing so, the department may enter into a contract with a regional, local, or state agency to create this statewide maintenance team. DEED must acquire ownership of all designs, and DEED shall assess the potential co-location of facilities in consultation with the Department of Administration and Department of Transportation. Any agency or organization that is co-located in a school facility must have the background check requirements that a teacher must have. And just a side note of information, 24% of schools in Alaska are under 50% full or utilized, and 29% are under 75% full or utilized. What this means is that there's a possibility of co-location in 53% of our schools. Sections 1 through 7 relate to grant applications for school construction, and then Section 8 relates to bond reimbursement for school construction. So Section 1 requires additional information in a school district's grant application, including information demonstrating that the project incorporates requirements under Section 9 and documentation of the building commissioning process. Section 2, DEED shall verify that the district applying for a grant follows the recommendations made in Section 9, and the project must achieve savings measured by a life cycle cost analysis achieved through the use of standardized options, energy efficiency upgrades, and fuel cost reductions. Section 3, the Department of Education may reduce a project budget by the cost of those portions of the project design that the department determines does not meet the criteria set out by Section 9 of this bill. Section 4, when a school district is applying for a grant, the department shall consult with Alaska Energy Authority to make sure that the projects are in compliance with the criteria established in Section 9. Section 5 requires the Bond Reimbursement and Grant Review Committee, along with their other duties, to analyze designs acquired by the state and set standards based on the standards adopted in Section 9. Section 6 requires that a school district must include criteria developed in Section 9 when they are seeking a grant for school construction. The school district must not exceed the maximum cost standards per square foot established by Section 9. And it disallows any school districts, contractors, architects, or designers involved with the design and building of a school facility from applying for an architectural award if the grant is an amount equal to or greater than 50% of the project. This does not exclude energy efficiency awards or innovative design awards. Section 7, if a cost of a project exceeds the maximum cost standards established by Section 9, the municipality or REAA must then pay for those excess costs outside of state funds. Section 8, as I stated earlier, relates to bond reimbursement for school construction and requires a Commissioner of Education to not approve of an application for bond reimbursement unless the municipality agrees to construction of an appropriate-sized school facility that meets the criteria developed in Section 9 of this bill. And in assessing this criteria, the Commissioner of Education shall consult with Alaska Energy Authority. The municipality must provide reasonable assurance that the project cost will not exceed the maximum cost standard, and if they do, they will have to pay for it out of other than state funds. And if a project receives bond reimbursement of 50% or more of the cost of the project, no one may receive a design award, architectural design award. Section 11 is the applicability section. Section 12, DEED shall adopt regulations necessary to implement the changes made by this act. The regulations must implement the recommendations of the working group. And sections 13 through 15 are effective dates. Would the chair like me to go over the effective dates?
Yes, go ahead.
So section 13 allows sections 1 through 9 and 11 take effect 24 months after the passage of this bill. Section 14 establishes Section 10 takes effect immediately after passage of this bill, and Section 15 takes Section 12 takes effect 18 months after the passage of this bill.
Okay, thank you very, very much. Good job, Brittany. Good overview, Senator McKinnon. Are there questions from committee members? Senator Coghill? Go ahead, Senator Coghill.
Just a couple of straightforward ones. I think I got the idea on the effective dates, but it looks like once the recommendations come back, they would start going immediately into regs. And because we do some capital budgeting, is there any reporting mechanism? Is that something that that we as a legislature need to review? That was just top of the head thought that in case it started taking a life of its own, how we might be able to look at that. For example, we have the there's a real strong push to do the LEED standards over against some of the criteria you put in here, and so it could wander up that way. It could wander away from it. It's just so going straight into regulations without any legislative review, since the payment is that something you thought about?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, thank you for the question. That is definitely something we've thought about. It's been brought up. It is not currently in the bill, but it's up to the senator, but I think that it would be something intelligent to consider.
Senator McKinnon, do you have any follow-up? Did you have anything else, Senator Coghill?
No, there's one other question I have, but I'll wait, Senator Begich, because I'm still formulating the thought. I don't want to ask a really dumb question.
But. Senator Begich.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator McKinnon, when I was looking through, there's two references when I was looking through the bill on in Section 8 on lines 19 and 20, you reference the Alaska Energy Authority, and then again back in Section 4, is it Section 4, on page 4, lines 15 and 16, the consultations with the Alaska Energy Authority in this bill. One of the things that I'm aware of when we discuss this with Brittany in my office is that a lot of, pretty much all of our sustainable and energy efficiency work is being done by DOTPF right now. Would there be a consideration of potentially changing the consulting party in this?
Through the chair, Senator Begich, thank you for your recommendation yesterday, and that actually has been brought up to us before. I believe by AEA it's been brought up to us, and so that is also a I consider it a friendly change that it's considered to be made. If I would like to ask DOT what they think, if they would be amenable to that.
Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Bakage. Whoever can do the task the most efficiently is where we would like it to reside. As I understand it, we've seen a new fiscal note from the Department of Education. AEA certainly is a qualified entity. Alaska Housing Finance has energy standards and has worked with this process before, which we've reached out to them. Alaska Cold Climate is another area that has some expertise. So there are many pieces of expertise. In fact, inside of Department of Education, there are many handbooks that talk about energy efficiency. And we appreciate all of the efforts of the department and what they've done. But we believe it's time, given the climate situation and the energy costs throughout Alaska, that we take a legislative look at some of these procedures. So Senator Coghill, in response to your thought, I think that that it would be a friendly amendment for the legislature to review what the task force comes up with. One of the challenges in reaching this piece of legislation was an insert that I made into the capital budget years ago, asking for the Department of Education to go through design specification standards and look to see if we could actually standardize some of the designs. And when they let that contract, I was disappointed to say that the same firm that would actually benefit from new creative designs each time we go through something was given the authority to, from my position, I just assert that they may have had some personal invested interest into having individual designs everywhere. That's me. They certainly have facts that support their thought process that everything needs to be unique, but I don't agree with that. I think that we can standardize and do some things better. So wherever this resides, this is a work in process. I have no problem in shaping this in response to people's concerns. My only eye is on the prize, and that's an efficient building for people both in urban and rural Alaska, and that when state dollars are invested in a project, that we know that our students are going to be warm, that they're going to have lights, and that we have backup energy in the appropriate areas so that if those lights go out, that we can keep those families warm and that we have a facility that can be used year-round versus just a part of the year. So if we all can keep that goal in mind at wanting to do what's best with the use of those dollars, then I think that we'll win. And I'm certainly willing to take the time and not need to push this through this legislative session.
Follow-up, Senator Bakage?
Sure. I should have prefaced by saying I really like the concept of the bill. The one of the things that we did at the Division of Juvenile Justice, Senator, was we worked on template designs because it was a more efficient way of doing the job. And your bill provides for up to 7 different template designs and the working group. In fact, the fact that you've got the Cold Climate Housing Research Center and Jack and Bear involved, these are all the right steps if you're going to do this process appropriately, and I know you know that, and I know you've been thinking about it for years. I did want to ask another question, though, if that's okay, Madam Chair.
Senator Bakage?
On page 7, if we could look at lines 20, 21, and 22, my suggestion here would just be to tighten the language perhaps a bit or come up with a clear definition. When we say must be adjusted for different regions within each climate zone, I did look through statute to try to find a clear definition of what a region within a climate zone is. We also found a number of different representations of what a climate zone was. So if we could be maybe tighten that down and make that a bit clearer. One of the things I don't want to have happen is in the Yukon-Koyukuk area in the map that was provided, you'll note that there's the community of Venati is in there, as well as you have the community of Fort Yukon. Both have radically different transportation costs and other costs, but might be considered in the same region. And I don't want to essentially create a situation where you can never build a school in a community because of those outstanding costs. My own recommendation would be to consider some community or groupings of communities that may already exist. And had you thought about that, or is there a way that is that potentially a friendly amendment to the bill?
Senator Begich, again, this is a process, and the Education Committee is part of that process. We're happy for you to do what you believe is best for this bill.
My last comment, Madam Chair.
Senator Begich.
One other thing that came up in my office was a desire to perhaps apply these standards to more than just school buildings, but we might want to look at this kind of design for other public buildings. But in the idea of co-location, in a bill that's going to be heard later today in committee, the Senator Hughes, the chair, has proposed potentially co-locating structures and buildings or collaboration with other entities. Would these standards apply then to those co-located structures, or have you given that thought yet if that bill were to pass as well?
Madam Chair, Senator Begich, yes, the chairman and I have talked on multiple occasions about co-location. Our desire is that the bills would fit together. We certainly want the structures throughout Alaska to be treated equally.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I have a question. First of all, thank you very much for bringing this forward. It's overdue. And when I saw in your sponsor statement the amount that we've spent on school facilities and then the energy cost is more than a third of that, I think it's very overdue. I was wondering, I noticed for energy efficiency improvements, that's discussed in the bill. What if just a basic remodel or addition were done on a school facility? Would it go through this process, or would it just be for new construction?
Madam Chair, it would go through this process. The idea is that we'll probably reconstruct more items in our near future than build new. We do have many new schools that are waiting to be built, specifically in rural Alaska, which is why we're advancing this conversation now. I know that all of those local school boards are concerned with energy efficiency and may or may not have the resources available to understand the choices both in construction material, insulation, or other, and some may. So there is a variety of expertise out in rural Alaska, and the state, from my position, should be leading the way in providing the information so that those school districts can make the appropriate choices for their communities. But if there is a 50% investment of dollars from the state of Alaska, it would trigger this bill.
I haven't followed it lately because I'm not doing health care work like I was in the past, and I know the funds have dwindled, but the Denali Commission has provided funding for clinic facilities, and I'm not sure what the status, if there's that much of that happening anymore, but have you looked into that as far as if, for instance, any federal requirements that might need to be met so that they could co-locate with a public school facility?
Madam Chair, the only response I have for you right now is that we would expect the department to handle and work collaboratively within the task force and make sure that we were open to anything and everything that we could for co-location. If the state is spending money there, I believe that we should be looking at how we can utilize those dollars best and maximize the return for the people in the region, the building that's being affected, and the state for long-term investment. And Madam Chair, with a little latitude, the Department of Transportation, as an example, when they look at Tuxuk Bay, Nayamute, and there's one other, I'm forgetting the third village that is along a corridor that's about 15 miles long, we're building three airports there, three schools, because to maintain the 15 miles from DOT's perspective is cost efficient. Because right now they have three contractors, and those contractors are doing a great job in those smaller communities in being able to clear the airport runways. And I can't remember the cost, but let's just say if 100,000 were right, I'm just trying to give you the magnitude, 100,000, it would cost more to maintain that 15 miles open than that 100,000. Maybe it would cost $1 million to maintain the mile. And again, I'm just trying to be somewhat proportional, though I know I have that wrong. So from their perspective, in their budget, it is a good thing to maintain three separate airports. But what they don't consider is that for the state, we're building three different high schools, or they don't each have high schools. But we're maintaining three different schools, three different health aid, three of everything is happening, and those communities want that. I don't want to represent that they'd like to co-locate, because they like their individuality and they want to remain as a separate community. But from the state's perspective, when we're funding three different things, we could fund one thing possibly at a greater level and have greater opportunities for the kids that might be affected by that if we brought those kids together. And the balance in that conversation belongs to the people in that region and to the state, with how we want to balance the individual local control versus the state's ability to actually stand up three different facilities. And why I bring that, Madam Chair, to here is that's what we're talking about. Let's just raise our heads a little bit further than where we're looking in a community for educational investment. And if we just go one step further, for me, when I heard about Little Diomede waiting for a helicopter to come in for us to find out that their electrical generation was down, why wouldn't we have an emergency operations center in almost all of the facilities that we have around? Because they will become community hubs. I think of the 64 earthquake and where people had to run to gather. In smaller communities, it's typically a school, because it has communication and it has the things. And so I just think that we need to look, from my personal perspective, we need to look a little bit higher at how we're deploying state dollars. And I certainly don't want one thing to fit all, because it won't. It needs to be a regional conversation and not a state conversation. But just so we look at our dollars and those investments a bit differently.
Senator Begich.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator McKinnon, just based on the whole idea of wanting to be more efficient then, and part of the title says relating to school construction and major maintenance grants and bond debt reimbursement. And so what I'm about to suggest to you is actually fits in the title, and so I'm talking about it in concept. And I didn't mention this to you yesterday because I didn't, until this moment, I didn't see the connection. But one of the things I've thought about for a number of years is how we could use the REAA and Small Schools Fund to also address major maintenance issues. I have some conceptual language that I will bring by your office and share with your staff, but is that something you might consider in a bill like this? Because it would fit into the bill in a sense, because it would be suggesting that we could tap that fund for use of major maintenance as well for those same schools. You're talking about not building new schools and actually retrofitting. And this might be a place where we could take care of two birds with one stone without violating a title.
Madam Chair, Senator Begich, we're certainly willing to look at any type of language. One of the things as a capital budget chairman that I've tried to discourage is using one-time money for reoccurring expenses. And so I would need to go back in history and look at how the fund was established to understand whether it dovetails or whether it's a different use of funds. But again, this is a work in process. I come to you for your expertise as representatives across different areas of Alaska to make the bill better. I think we have an admirable goal. I think that there are people that like how we are doing things today and don't want to see that change. I understand that. I know that it costs money sometimes to change. And then I also know that sometimes we use money to block change if we don't want to make change. And so this is the people's money. I think that we should do what we can that is best for the people and the students of Alaska. And if I could, Senator Begich, it's not that I'm not saying there won't be new construction, because there are schools that are scheduled for new construction that will go forward. The issue is that we've been through a process of building in the past. We have hundreds of millions of dollars out in bonds, and that it's more likely that we would see a lot of reconstruction or major maintenance. And so they would have to comply with these standards, because that's the whole point, is trying to have those investments last longer.
I have a question, and just because you've been studying this, you probably know. When a school is going to be built, is there an analysis done to project the size of the community, whether it will be growing or shrinking? Because it was pretty interesting in opening remarks that 53% of our schools are not at capacity. So is that required now, do you know?
Madam Chair, I believe it is, that they look at the growth patterns when they propose a specifically new building construction. Sometimes those figures change, and sometimes people just don't believe those figures. I have to say that I was one of those PTA presidents who just didn't believe the figures that were being proposed for the Eagle River High School. I was a new mom with a kindergartner in a high school of going over 2,000, and the community had great dialogue about needing a second high school. We chose to go forward and build half of a high school, per se, and be able to add for the additional student population. But the growth is more in line with what the actual numbers were, and I frankly didn't believe them at the time because of the growth we were seeing, you know, in the moment. And so I would just say that, you know, everyone can be wrong and everybody can be right, and it's about trying to do what you think is best with the information that you have before you. So I believe that they're considered, that calculation is considered, but they have to fight through those estimates through the general public who may be watching something very different, which is why I say that it was very different. Eagle River was booming when we were looking at the second high school in Eagle River, and you know, 10 years later now, actually almost 20, we're seeing a decline in student enrollment inside of schools across Alaska. So there are different things, and populations are relocating. In fact, Madam Chairman, they're moving to your community in great numbers. And so your schools, as you know, are being stressed. And Matt Sue certainly has approached me in trying to utilize school debt reimbursement possibly differently than just having to build another building, but try to use those funds in a different way that might leverage different types of learning.
Yes, thank you for that. We build a new school and we're immediately using portables, so it is a different situation for sure. I have another question because my daughter and husband were stationed in Germany, and I was blessed to be able to go over there and visit, and was really impressed with the age of buildings and how they were being used, buildings hundreds of years old. And so I have another question, whether there is any consideration for the durability and extending the life of our buildings. It seems that that we're a school, I don't know the age, I'm just going to throw out 20, 30 years old, and then we think we need a new school. And whereas in Europe, the school building might be 500, 600 years old. So, and I know we have harsh weather, and but is there any consideration as far as extending the life of the buildings?
Madam Chair, absolutely. We had a conversation about whether we should insert 50 years into the conversation. So we're certainly open to you looking at the number that we've chosen. I believe we picked a number closer to the life of a typical mortgage, just because it was something that is in the books that people can measure. But again, we leave it to you. We had a conversation around building a school that should last 50 years because, like you, in other states, let alone other nations, other states certainly are seeing construction that lasts much longer than is happening in Alaska, which is why we think we should own some designs so that if we have problems with them, that we can identify it, try to work with the design community to rebuild it so that it could go out in phase two or phase three with those same consultants to make the project better each time instead of building new designs that create some of their own issues.
Thank you. Are there other questions?
If I may, Madam Chair.
Brittany?
Thank you. In Section 10, it does say that the standardized component options must result in buildings with a 30-year lifespan and renovations in a 20-year lifespan. However, we are open to changing that number.
Okay. Thank you. Members, do you have other questions? Senator Coghill.
Just on the ownership question, I take it we don't own the designs right now, but would it require that we stand up a kind of an expertise in managing and reading and applying some of these designs once we have them? And is that a change in our venue, put it that way?
Madam Chair, Senator Coghill, I think that the department believes it is. I personally believe it's their responsibility right now. I was somewhat disappointed that we don't own our designs. From the design community perspective, which we reached out to, each school is unique. Each school has a different landscape, a different foundation as far as seismic capability. each needs different kinds of power. And so, again, going back to the report that that I asked for, it suggests that it can't be done and that everything needs to be unique. And, you know, whether I've just disclosed that I may not have been right on the population growth from a PTA mom's perspective in advocating for her son's second high school, but I doubt that everything needs to be unique, that there's got to be some standardized components that we could do. And I don't want to take money away from the design community or stop their creativity, but I think that public buildings have a responsibility to be energy efficient and functional before they need to be beautiful. And both can be combined, and reusing designs can cause construction efficiencies. So with that same building for Eagle River High School, I don't know if you remember Herb Chamberlain. He was somewhat of a curmudgeon at times, as described by some. By others, a wonderful father, husband, and other things. But I was on that show during my early election, and they asked me about design standards, and I said, well, Eagle River reused a design. We saved $1 million, Senator Coghill. We were able to put in fields that the community thought we'd never be able to, and it was because, from my perspective, we reused the design in the same construction team, and so they built the building faster, and that's the whole point. For me, especially in rural Alaska, when we're bringing out, you know, the transportation just to get the supplies to the area is so cost prohibitive that, you know, we need to be very careful, just as Senator Begich points out, that if you're off the transportation system, that your cost to acquire just the supplies may be so much higher. So is it a new role? I think it should have been an existing role with all the money we have out there. But if someone else can handle it better than the Department of Education, I'm open to that if that's somehow something new for them to do.
Senator Begich.
Senator McKinnon, I wanted to both support what you just said and reiterate the experience of the Division of Juvenile Justice. If you go to the now returned Ketchikan facility or the Nome facility or the Mat-Su facility or the new additions that were made at McLaughlin at the time, they all are built off the same basic template. They all look different, but they're all built off the same basic template. And the template was used because classrooms had cells had a specific size. They had specific requirements, and it just simplified the process. In that particular instance, the same company was doing all of them, so it was efficient for them to do it. But, you know, you're talking about seven basic templates, if I understand the bill correctly, that the templates would not be specifically held to if you just mentioned seismic, if the climate conditions were different. So I pick number two, but I live in a place that's on a cliff like the Ketchikan facility was, so I have to adjust number two to fit the cliff, which is my site. Is that correct, basically?
Madam Chair, Senator Begich, we want to provide local flexibility to do what the community thinks is best and what an architect would think is safe. We want everyone to do their jobs and just raise their heads up a little bit higher to say, whether it's a template, whether there's seven, two, or nine, I'm not locked into anything. What I am locked into is using the limited dollars available to Alaskans to create energy efficiencies. It may require some design, some footprint changes for the education. We may need to allow larger square footage to allow co-location of a health clinic. As an example, most of the smaller communities may not have a nurse in their building. Well, if we have a health aide in the community, I'm not sure why it's not co-located in a separate entrance so that people would not see that privacy would be protected if it could be accommodated. I see that as a win-win for both the health aide and the children and the community that may need something health-wise. So I know it change is difficult, but it seems that we need to be smarter with how we do things, and I'm happy to use templates as a base. And again, I'm not locked into a particular number or anything, but we absolutely believe there are design components, templates in your words, that could be used.
Follow-up comment.
Just even as long ago as 1994, the Governor's Conference on Youth and Justice established that there would be, in new school design, health clinics designed, plumbed, electrical would be provided for those with separate entrances. So you are both ahead of your time and in this regard, but also, regretfully, nobody paid attention to that for 25 years, and now we're at a place where we're going to perhaps see it happen. So thank you for that.
And to follow up what you mentioned about the clinics and the health aides, I've had some public health nurses visit me here in the building recently. And back in the early days of statehood, we didn't have all the clinics that we have, and we didn't have the health aid program like we have now. And they were the mainstay, and they do a lot of travel now and meet a lot of needs still at this time. But Senator Geisel could probably speak to this better because it's been a few years since I looked at it, but I was aware a few years ago that we had situations where we had a public health facility in a village and the clinic and the school. And because of budget constraints and the new fiscal reality that we're facing, not only the co-location might be something we should think about, but if for instance, a public health nurse were co-located in the school, that public health nurse perhaps could also be the school nurse. So those are the kind of things that we need to be thinking out of the box, and this type of arrangement would lend well to those kind of working arrangements too. And so I thought I would mention that. So, Senator Geisel.
Well, of course, that's exactly what I was thinking, Madam Chair. Thank you. And when Senator McKinnon and Brittany came to my office, outlined the bill, that is exactly what I was thinking. As someone that has worked in rural Alaska in the school, there's no clinic in the school. And so I would work in a teacher break room or a storage room and make do with those facilities, bringing my own equipment. This would really facilitate that expeditious provision of health care. And we're seeing it actually in Anchorage, where a private entity now is contracting using space in one of the middle schools and in the school nurse office and providing more efficient services. So I appreciate that about the bill especially. Thank you.
Do members have any other questions at this time? Senator Coghill.
It's really not a question. It's I like the way you put the group together. Certainly there are building standards that are heading towards energy efficiency already. So my guess is a lot of this stuff can be pulled right off the shelf and standardizing it. So I think the timeline is generous and maybe even too long. And I'm saying that because you can overdo some of these things by asking, I would say, tighten up the timeline with the idea of getting a working product a little earlier. So that's just a suggestion at this point, and that's first blush, so I'll be thinking about it. Thank you.
One last comment. Senator Begich.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would suggest perhaps looking at some paragraph or line. I don't have one to offer you, but that would look at rapidly changing technologies and making sure that you have a provision for ensuring that you don't get locked into supporting changes or circumstances that get you locked into old technologies. So have a robust mechanism for being able to be nimble in moving from technology to technology.
Thank you. I like that. I just want to say, as we close out, and we'll be setting this bill aside and looking at it again on Friday, is that it's interesting that I believe probably it was last summer, June maybe, between June and present, I received unsolicited calls from people in the construction industry, and I think they were very aware of what the state is facing, and they were gentlemen who had been out in rural areas building schools and very concerned about this very thing that you and they didn't know. It was probably five or six that I received in the last 8-9 months, just calls where they say we need to do something, and the next call I get, I'll be able to tell them about this bill. So I want to thank you for overviewing it for us, and we can think on it, and if we have further ideas, I know that you're open to it. You made that very clear. We appreciate that. We want to do what's best for the state and be wise stewards of our dollars. So thank you very much. And next, we are going to look at SB 96. And Joshua, if you would like to, we'll take a brief at ease, and Joshua will get situated at the table. Back on the record, and I am delighted to begin discussions on SB 96 with the committee. As you all know, we have, since the beginning of session, held a number of exploratory hearings, knowing that we have an obligation to offer our students the best education possible that we can. And considering the budget constraints, this, like the previous bill we heard, it was time for some out-of-the-box thinking. How can we offer tools to the districts so that they can do more with less and improve what we're offering students at the same time? And I had mentioned in one of the early hearings that something that I was told by a teacher, a very dedicated teacher in MATSU, sat down over coffee with me and made the remark that it has just been in my head all these months, and he said, we don't need to reform education, we need to transform it. And we need to come into the 21st century. The achievement gap that we have is startling and troubling. We have some wonderful schools and some excellent teachers. In fact, we have some schools that have 100% graduation rates, but we also have some schools that are struggling. And at this time, this bill, based on the input from all of you on this committee and what we've learned from the many presenters, we're bringing this together to try to improve education. I believe that every student matters, and I believe my colleagues agree with that statement. Every student in the state of Alaska matters. They each deserve an opportunity to access an excellent education, and I believe we can do a better job, and I believe we're obligated to do a better job. So that is the focus of this bill. And by improving and offering new opportunities to students for instruction, one of the things we also have to look at is how can we tighten the belt and be more efficient on the administrative end. And as we've heard in this committee and we've read in reports, overall spending on education does not correlate with academic achievement. However, spending on classroom instruction does correlate with academic achievement. And so that is what we're after in this bill. So I'm excited to begin this journey with all of you. And we know that there are things in the bill that we'll need to address and improve. But with that, I'm going to let Joshua begin and present the bill to you, and we'll begin the discussion. Thank you. Joshua?
Good morning, Madam Chair. For the record, Joshua Banks, staff of Senator Hughes. And as the Chair mentioned, there are some changes that we're working on that were requested by Ledge Legal to work in the CS. And as I go through the section, I'll point out some of those changes. And there should be a document on the members' desk giving a little detail on the changes that we're working on. Starting with Section 1, we're creating uncodified law for legislative findings of the Alaska Education Transformation Act in regards to virtual education spending, quality teachers, and classroom instruction. And based on the hearings that we've had in this session, we felt like these were good points to make as in regards to legislative intent for this bill. Sections 2 and 3 make technical amendments to AS 1403-073 to add references to specific subsections within this section due to section 4 of this bill, the changes made there. In section 4, we're adding a new subsection to AS 1403-073 and are requiring school districts to allow credit for gym, art, or music classes for a student that participates in an activity that meets the educational or physical requirements for the course. Included in this is cultural activities such as subsistence hunting or native dancing. Those were a few things we had in mind with this piece. Section 5 will amend AS 1403-120A to add a requirement to the annual report that school districts must submit to the Department of Education and Early Development. Districts will need to include categories of administrative employees and the ratio of employees in each category compared to the number of students in the district. And a couple changes that we're going to make to this section will require the district to post this report on if they have a website, and a number of smaller districts may not have a website, and so if there's other alternative means to make it readily available to the public, it's the purpose of this is to allow for the public to have districts be more accountable to the particularly the administrative costs associated with the district. Section 6 will amend AS 1403-030B to require the department to conduct one inspection for each school bus rather than two each year. Section 7 will amend AS 1414-110A to allow school districts to partner with businesses, nonprofit organizations, and state or local government agencies. The section also adds to the definition of administrative services to include student nutrition, student transportation, and health insurance pooling with the state insurance plan. The section also adds to the definition of educational services to include teacher training and the use of technology to teach students. Included in this is virtual education, such as the startup costs that a district might incur due to increase in use of virtual education. And insurance pooling, the purpose of this is primarily a conversation starter. We know that there's a study being worked on that will look at this issue more thoroughly, and that may end up being the vehicle for trying to help districts with their high health care costs. But pretty much every single district that's come to us has indicated that health insurance costs are one of the main drivers. And we want to start the conversation and try to figure out how we can help those districts deal with those ever-increasing costs. Section 8 will amend AS 1414-115A to allow school districts, again, to partner with businesses, nonprofit organizations, and state or local government agencies in order to qualify for the one-time grant under this section. This section will also increase the maximum amount allowed for the grant to $200,000.
I just want to, for the record, point out that Representative Parrish has joined us. Welcome.
And an additional change in Section 8 will be that the school district must demonstrate that they'll be able to save, that there will be cost savings associated with the grant. In Section 9, we'll be adding new subsections to AS 1414-115 to give further directions for the cooperative grants under this section. Subsection D will require that if two school districts enter into a cooperative grant, one must be a rural district. And the purpose of this is not to discourage urban districts such as Anchorage and Matsu to work together, but we felt like rural districts don't have the margin to the extra funds to pay for the startup costs for some of these agreements, and we felt like that would be the most appropriate way of dealing with these grants. The new subsection E will establish that if a cooperative grant is used for health insurance pooling with the state, the grant can only be used for to pay for the cost of transferring district employees to the state insurance plan. Subsection F will allow school district to carry forward the savings realized during the first 3 years after a grant is awarded, and these savings will not be counted towards the fund balance limit established in AS 1417505A. And finally, in Section 9, Subsection G will define rural school district as a regional education attendance area or a small municipal school district defined in AS 1411025C, which is a district that has less than 300 in average daily membership and a district full value per ADM of less than $500,000. Section 10 will amend AS 1417450A to provide an exception to the school size adjustment for schools that meet the qualifications in subsection G of this section, which is in section 11. And that section 11 will amend AS 1417450 by adding a new subsection establishing that a school may not use the school size adjustment under A of this section if it is below 80% capacity and if it is within 25 miles by road of another school in the same district that is also below 80% capacity. And in working with the department, we have realized there may be some unintended consequences with this change, and so we're working on adjusting this section in the new CS so that there won't be as many schools that will be negatively affected by this change, and our intent is for schools to use their full capacity and to make it so that rather than, for example, having 10 schools at 50% capacity, the school district will have 5 schools at full capacity, because those fixed costs of the principals, the heating costs, the utilities, they're paying for all those costs whether the school is at 50% capacity or 100% capacity, and we want to use this as a way to help school districts bring down those fixed costs.
Joshua, before you go on, can you also explain one of the changes as far as how the funding would work as a school would merge with another school that in the upcoming change?
Madam Chair, when two schools, if they merge, then the school count will be changed, and in the school size adjustment table within section that you'll see in section 10.
I was referring to the three-year funding change. If you just explain that, I think that might be helpful for people to know at this point. It will come out in the CS.
Absolutely, Madam Chair. An additional change that we're working on would be to phase in if there is any a reduction in the ADM for the schools, is to phase that in over 3 years rather than have schools have a major drop in funding. In Section 12, we're amending AS 1417505A to increase the limit that a school district is allowed to retain in its unreserved fund balance from 10% to 25% of district expenditures, and this section also allows for savings retained from a cooperative grant under AS 1414115 to not count towards the 25% limit. Section 13 amends AS 1420020I to require the state school board to periodically adjust the minimum score needed to pass the practice exam, which is the exam that teachers must pass in order to be certified in the state, so that Alaska has the higher testing standards for certifications. And the state already does look at these scores annually, and so this will just be a way to see if the state is falling behind other states in regards to our testing standards. We'll be able to increase those and keep at the same pace as other states.
Joshua, I'm going to interrupt you, too, just because it's just such a good time to make sure that folks know. For the most part, for the major areas of competency, we are right up with other states at the score. I believe it was 160. But there were some courses, such as chemistry was an example, where other states were at 160 and we are at 138. And so we want to make sure our students have teachers that are very competent in these specific areas. So that's how that came to be.
And Madam Chair, the one change that we're looking at making in the new CS will be that if the state board, school board changes regulations, those changes will not go into effect until at least a year after the board approves it. That way, students that are preparing, taking class to become a teacher, they'll basically have a heads up before they know that the practice scores have been increased. In section 14, there'll be a new subsection to AS 1420-380 to require the Department of Education to provide administrative services to the Professional Teaching Practices Commission. And this was part of the performance review done by the department for the Department of Education. And this is, from my understanding, this is already being done. The department is already performing most, if not all, of the administrative services for the PTPC. But this is just to put it in statute so that we're ensuring that we're being as efficient as possible. And Section 15 essentially reiterates what 14 is doing and requiring the PTPC to use administrative support services provided by the department. Section 16 will create the Virtual Education Consortium, and the new subsections within AS 1437-60 consists of subsection A, which establishes the Virtual Education Consortium under the Department of Education. The consortium will have a database of virtual education courses available to all districts for students in grades 6 through 12. And we've heard in numerous hearings that a number of schools throughout the state have already been utilizing virtual education for middle school and high school students. And we wanted to just continue working on the progress that's been made in that area and keeping it to middle school and high school students. In addition to this, the consortium will also provide training for teachers, instructing in the virtual setting. And this, as we've heard again in committee hearings, that this training is necessary due to the differences in classroom training and the virtual settings. The consortium will also provide professional development for all teachers in the state. And also that school district or a third-party vendor may offer courses on the database, provided that the courses are approved by the department. In subsection B, the department will review each course to ensure that it meets state standards and that the course material is appropriate for students in grades 6 through 12. The subsection also requires that each course has the following information: the title, subject, the description of the course, the district providing the course, the method of virtual education delivery, and that being asynchronous, synchronous, or blended, and samples of the course curriculum and teacher instruction provided in the course. And that includes introductory videos of the teacher, and if a class is a synchronous course, then they'll be required to put a video of the teacher in the classroom teaching so that students can see and in a way get to know the teacher before they're taking the class. Subsection C requires the consortium to provide training for teachers before they're allowed to teach a course that's included in the database, and there'll be a waiver that the department can give if a teacher either has experience teaching in a virtual setting or if they just have the skills in their teaching style that allows them to deal with the differences in the virtual and classroom settings. Subsection D requires the consortium to provide professional development courses for all teachers in the state, and any district that has adequate broadband access to participate in the trainings shall require its teachers to participate in the trainings. And the consortium may also require the participating districts to adopt the same in-service days for this training. And the incentive of this is that districts that do this will not be paying any fees for this professional development. Subsection E sets a fee structure for students that take a course offered virtually by a school district that's not their own home school district. The student's district shall calculate the fee by multiplying the base student allocation by the proportion of classes that the student is taking in the district that's offering the course, and the student's district shall pay the fee to the district offering the course. For example, if you have a student in TOC taking a class in the Anchorage, virtually from the Anchorage School District, if that student's taking seven courses, for example, then 1/7 of the BSA will be paid by the Alaska Gateway School District to the Anchorage School District. In subsection F, the consortium is allowed to charge a fee to any school district that offers a course in the database under B of the section. The department will be able to set the fee in regulation and can adjust it annually as necessary. And the fees must be set in a manner that by June 30th of 2020, the fees paid by districts will be able to cover the operating costs of the consortium.
Joshua, can you talk about the change that we're planning for that one?
Absolutely, Madam Chair. And the change that we're working on is so that making it so that all participating districts will pay a fee, so that it's not just if a district is just has students taking courses on the consortium but not offering courses, then they'll pay a fee for the consortium. In subsection G, we're allowing the consortium to have districts, if it chooses to have districts provide courses. It allow the consortium to require districts that provide courses or have students taking courses through the consortium to adopt a shared calendar and a shared bell schedule for at least a portion of the school day. And that is optional. Where we've heard from, we know the Copper River School District has adopted common calendar and common bell schedule, and it's resulted in a lot of administrative efficiencies, and we feel like, and we've also heard from other individuals that with synchronous courses, it'd be very difficult if districts were not on the same bell schedule to have that, to have a smooth synchronous virtual course. And in subsection H, we're creating definitions for the terms asynchronous, base student allocation, blended, host district, synchronous, and virtual education or virtual instruction. Section 17 deletes a reference to AS 2310065B within the Alaska Wage and Hour Act, and that section is repealed in Section 23 of the bill, which I'll go over in a little bit. Section 18 deletes reference to AS 3714110C, which is repealed in Section 24 of this bill, and Section 18 also rearranges the reference to AS 3714160. Section 19 deletes language in AS 3714130 that requires the Public School Fund Advisory Board to prepare accounting specifically for the principal and the income of the Public School Trust Fund. Section 20 deletes language in AS 3714160 relating to separate accounting of the principal and income of the Public School Trust Fund. And this section also requires that the Department of Revenue to determine each year the monthly average market value of the fund for the last three fiscal years. And this is in order to set up the school trust fund as in a POMV style so that more funds are available for public education. And Section 21, it creates a new section in AS 3714 to allow the legislature to appropriate 4.75% of the market value established with the changes in Section 20 of this bill. Funds may be used to support public education in Alaska and to cover the administrative costs of the fund. And we're making a change to the section so that no more than 4.75% can be appropriated, and that the legislature will not be able to appropriate more than what the income that was earned by the fund in the previous fiscal year. And the intent of those changes is to avoid any possibility of the legislature appropriating from the principal of a fund, which would be in violation of trust law. In Section 22, we're amending AS 3714170 to allow the Commissioner of the Department of Revenue to invest the public school trust fund in order to provide increasing returns from capital appreciation. Section 23 repeals AS 1420-470A7 so that the PTP, the Professional Teaching Practices Commission, is no longer able to appoint an executive secretary. This section also repeals AS 2310-065B and C, which requires an employer to pay a public school bus driver at a rate 2 times the Alaska minimum wage. And this also, in subsection C, allows for wage adjustments to only occur when a contract begins or is renewed. Section 24 repeals AS 3714110C, which sets how the Commissioner of Revenue will calculate the net income of the public school trust fund, and AS 3714140 is also repealed, which requires that the net income from the fund only goes towards funding public education. And that the repeal of 3714140, we're looking at taking that out of in the CS so that section is still in law, as we believe that the changes made in Section 21 regarding limiting how much the legislature can appropriate from the trust fund will deal with any legal problems that this may have caused. Section 25 will create applicability language for the repeal of AS 2310-065 B and C, which is the sections requiring bus drivers be paid double minimum wage. And this section will allow, so this bill will only affect contracts made on or after the effective date of this bill. Section 26, and in the CS, where we'll be deleting this section, it creates a conditional effect establishing that changes made to the public school trust fund will only go into effect if a final judgment is made regarding combining income and principal of this public school trust fund, and that such action will not violate trust law. Our understanding is that there is no litigation. There was formerly some litigation related to this, but our understanding is that that's no longer in play, and I'll certainly follow up with the committee to make sure that that's the case, but our understanding is that this section is not necessary. In Section 27, we're creating an effective date for Sections 18 through 22 and 24 to be the day after the Commissioner of the Department notifies the reviser of statutes that a final judgment has been made regarding the public school trust fund. And this, again, would be a section that will likely be deleted in the CS. Section 28, the final section, will create an effective date for Sections 1 through 17, 23, and 25 to be June 30th, 2017. With that, I can take any questions, and I will note that Dr. Susan McCauley is online to answer questions, as well as a number of folks from the Department of Education.
Thank you very much, Josh, and I just want to take this opportunity to thank you for all your work here since the session began, and we started looking at things. You've done a great job to get us started. So we'll open it now for questions. Senator Begich.
First, just a really quick technical point on Section 28. Josh, thank you, Madam Chair. You'll probably have to adjust that section too, related to the effective dates and the section numbers, because you've changed some of the others in here. I also want to thank you for the hard work you've done. You've reached out to myself and my staff and really taken pains to make sure that you're doing the bill that does what you intend it to do, as opposed to unintended consequences. I just want to draw your attention to a couple of points and just make sure we have those on the record, that we're addressing those. In Section 11, there's a couple things in there, and that's the section that relates to the 80% capacity, which I know you're going to be adjusting.
Can you mention the page number? Just
oh,
helps
I'm sorry,
us get there a little
six,
faster.
Page 6 on – sorry about that. Lines – it starts actually on page 5, but really this deals with the road issue and the nature of the capacity of schools. Three things just to keep in mind there. The first is that we don't end up through the process of doing this, and I know you're looking at this now and adjusting it, we don't end up with two schools you know, that are under capacity, and then you create one school that's extraordinarily over capacity as a result of the action. The second thing here is that you have to be very careful about prior Supreme Court decisions, and in particular the Molly Hooch decision in this regard. You've got to be sure when you're talking about you have to be sure that you're holding communities separate. In the prior testimony on the other bill, Senator McKinnon referred to three villages that were on a common road that were probably within 25 miles of each other. But each of those villages under the Molly Hooch decision has a right to a school if they have a population. So you have to be very careful that you're not creating a constitutional situation here. And that leads me to my last point on that section, and that is that just also be cognizant that you need a clear definition of what you mean by road. When we discussed this, outside of committee and talked about what that might mean, there are different standards for roads. We don't want a trail to be considered a road, which, by the way, during litigation and reapportionment and other issues, trails were considered roads. So we got to be very careful that we don't make a sort of a reach or a stretch there, and that we're clear in the language. On the praxis exam, I just wondered, was there a grandfathering in that you were going to do? Where we talked, I thought, about a phased in approach with that, where so that you wouldn't suddenly lose a bunch of teachers potentially? Had we talked about that? If we hadn't, could you consider that?
Through the chair, Senator Begich, as in teachers that are currently certified,
sure.
The concern about
I would want
them losing their certification.
Correct.
Through Chair Senator Begich, we'll ensure that that is not the case. That it will be a grandfathering then.
I just have two other quick points.
Senator Begich, go ahead.
On the issue of the fee, this is a set fee for sure. I thought initially we had talked about potentially if a district didn't want to charge a fee that wouldn't be the case, but this would in fact set a fee. I just want to clarify it. I don't have an objection either way, and that's on page 8, just looking in that section there, on sections E and F.
Through the chair, Senator Begich, our intent was that if a school district chose to not take the full fee, that this would be just a ceiling for what a school district could charge. And if we need to make additions to this to clarify that, we definitely intend that.
Right, and I think is the fee could be zero, so that it could be zero to that amount. So, Senator Begich?
On line 22, you might just look at changing the shall to may there, and that perhaps could address the issue. And so that's just to allow the option. And then finally, I want to be clear that we are talking about the one area I've discussed to you that I might have some problem with was the issue of the double minimum wage bus driver repeal issue, and I hope that becomes more clear in testimony, but I wanted to be sure that in your section 24 in the document you provided us, you talked about that 37.14.140 will no longer be repealed. This is on page 14, and I'm looking at line 3. And in your testimony just now, there was just a little ambiguity about that. That is a really important issue for me because that relates to how we use the school trust fund, and I know your intent is that it should be used for public education. If we repeal that section, we lose that language. I just wanted to reinforce that. I know that your intent is to repeal delete the 37.14.140. I just want to be sure that we are going to do that.
Through the chair, Senator Begich, in the draft request, the CS draft request, we are requesting that legal delete that portion.
Thank you. I have no further questions at this time, Madam Chair.
Senator Giesel, do you have anything at this time?
Madam Chair, only bravo to your staff. This is very well done, and I appreciate the hard work. Thanks.
Thank you. Senator Coghill?
I'm still digesting it, Madam Chair.
Well, I since we when you did the overview, the minimum wage issue was just referred to as statute numbers, and you brought it up. I will just mention, just to be clear, that this would not prohibit a district from continuing to pay twice the minimum wage. But we did hear from districts that some of their drivers are very experienced, and then they may bring in a newer driver, and it might make sense to have some flexibility. So that is will be up to the districts. Senator Begich.
I'm glad you said that, Madam Chair, because I forgot to ask the question about the inspection. It's being dropped from 2 to 1. I want to be sure we're not putting at risk public safety in that section, and I assume that there have been discussions regarding that issue, the change of the inspections for buses.
Yes.
That was, I'm sorry, that was earlier in the bill. Page 3, thank you, Senator Giesel.
Josh, do you want to speak to that?
Absolutely, Madam Chair. Through the Chair, Senator Begich, this is in similar fashion to the minimum wage sections that if the department feels that it's necessary to do 2 inspections or 3 inspections, then they're certainly able to. This just sets the requirement that only one is necessary, but if two is required, if they feel like 2 is more appropriate, then they certainly can.
And just a brief follow-up clarification, thank you, Madam Chair. Also, too, I wanted to just for the record, when you were referring to the constitutional issue around the public schools trust, that came out of the Casale lawsuit and was part of the consent decree was to end that piece of litigation. There was another piece of litigation that was filed, I believe, regarding this issue by a group on the Kenai Peninsula. And I don't know the status of that. I don't think I don't know if it's current at all. But I know that the issue which was adjudicated that language referred to was suspended by the consent decree in Casale. So it is off. That issue is off the table as far as those plaintiffs. And I was involved in that lawsuit, as you know.
Okay. Well, thank you for those remarks. And I think we all have a lot to think about. We are open to continuing to discuss if you and those in the public and involved in the education community, if you have ideas, we welcome you. Come to Joshua, and we will we'll pick this bill up again and continue the discussion. And we hope to have a CS. Joshua, when are we expecting to fix some of the errors that we knew right away that needed to be fixed? So when do we expect that?
Madam Chair, we're hoping to have it by tomorrow's meeting,
okay.
But we're working with legal to get that.
Okay, and we also, of course, will give the department a chance to speak, and we'll be looking forward to input from those also that will be impacted by this. So with that, we are going to meet an extra meeting tomorrow, March 23rd at 8 a.m., and we will be in the Belts room, not this room, and we will continue on the work on this bill. And seeing no other business before the committee, we will adjourn at 9:22 a.m. Thank you.